From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The educator and writer Debbie Irving says the hardest part about understanding how racism works is acknowledging it in yourself. In the book she wrote, she mentions this sense of tension she felt being around people of color, how she kept choosing friends who were white. She even confessed to unwanted racist thoughts. Irving says racism holds all of us captive in ways we rarely imagine. We worry about appearing stupid, so we guard ourselves, and usually we stay silent. For Debbie Irving, waking up to her whiteness, to her life of privilege, helped her understand racism better and its ability to shape our values and our behavior. And that's what we're talking about today. We hope you'll join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Race or racism is hard to talk about for all kinds of different reasons. One of them is that we have feelings about race that we're kind of uncomfortable about. Often it's just a general sense of fear or anxiety about saying something stupid or doing something stupid. Sometimes it's an idea, a thought that slips into our minds that we would really never dare express out loud, and it makes us feel ashamed. The writer and educator Debbie Irving says this happens a lot, and it puts a lot of white people on guard, which means no one dares talk about the problem or how you solve it. The writer Theodore Johnson says there needs to be this confession or this admission that blackness is uncomfortable to others to get the conversation about race going and to do something about it. Today on the program, we're talking about racism in America, and we're hoping to hear from you. Was there a moment in your past when you may have been racially insensitive? Maybe you felt uncomfortable when driving in a particular neighborhood and you reached over and locked the car door. How do you change those tendencies? And there's, of course, this overreaching question, what does it mean to be racist in America today? Joining us first on the program is Theodore Johnson III. He is a U.S. Navy commander and a White House fellow. He's a commentator on race and politics and a writer, as I mentioned. He's written articles for The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, and Salon.com. He's joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. And we should point out that his comments today are his own and not those of the U.S. Navy or the U.S. government. And Theodore Johnson, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with the story you tell in an essay you wrote for The Atlantic a while back. And you tell this, it's really a very sort of simple, straightforward story. And I wanted to have you work through this with us because it's an experience where you had one morning, you had gone to run at this high school track. And as you're running, there were these two white women who were out for a walk on the track. And so you had to kind of get past them, move past them.
Right.
But I wanted you to talk about that because you say you felt this instinctive need to shrink, is how you put it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I talk about what I wore, and I was very intentional about what I wear, and specifically in those times when I'm going to be out and may encounter folks where they don't expect to see me, like in a – and the town where I was running was about 2 or 3% black. So to be at the high school on an early Sunday morning is not a place where these women would have expected to see a black man. So I walked there. Actually, I drove there, but I got onto the track and I was certain to wear my Harvard T-shirt and my U.S. Navy shorts as another marker, another indicator that, hey, I'm not a threat to you, you know, or anyone else that I encounter. This is these sorts of signals make me safe, or at least that was the logic. So once I got on the track, you know, and I saw them, the thing is, the onus is on me to make sure that they don't feel threatened. And that may not have been a conscious something that they consciously exerted in my direction, but it's what I brought to the track based on past experiences. And that's what racism is. It isn't a personal relationship that sort of reinvigorates itself in every encounter. It's a history of interactions that you then take to your next set of interactions and then govern the way you interact with other people. And so I brought my past experiences to that track. Those women could have smiled at me and been the friendliest people on earth, but I wouldn't have known that had they not taken the initiative to do so. And the fact that they didn't even look in my direction, not even a good morning, which is customary for folks who run, let me know that I probably made the right move. I wasn't afraid that if I accidentally brushed against them or if I approached them too quickly from behind, they would scream and yell. But again, if there had been a misunderstanding, it's up to me to make it clear, you know, or to not be the threat anymore. It's the onus is not on them to show that I was the threat. Immediately, it's assumed that the black guy out in the middle of nowhere on a Sunday morning chasing these two women around the track is sort of the guy at fault. I'm being a little flip, but only to show how other interactions in other places. How you bring those experiences to new interactions.
So let me ask you about your part in that, what you're doing, because you write about, and I'm wondering if it's even conscious, because you talk about how you change your body language and your expression to be more, even more, again, beyond just the clothing that you actually, you know, consciously picked out.
Right.
Was it more kind of a more submissive kind of expression? And were you really even conscious of it at the time? I mean, do you work this stuff out or is it just the way you act?
Yeah. And so it, submissive is definitely not the right word, but non-threatening is the posture. And it is both involuntary and sort of a conscious act at the same time. It's actually quite odd. So I knew as I passed by them, I intentionally made my footsteps heavier, right? So that I would not suddenly appear beside them. And I did that every time I lapped them around the track, just as again, so that there's no misunderstanding, that there's an awareness that this interaction was about to take place.
Right.
That was very conscious. In my posture as to sort of swing wide, that actually just sort of happened on its own. So the thing about race is like, or past racist experiences, really, you can't bend them off and say that I'm only going to acknowledge that this might be an uncomfortable situation in these instances and take these actions. And then any involuntary action will happen in these other set of circumstances that I have no control over. It sort of pervades everything you do, the way you think, the way you comport yourself in society at large. And so there are involuntary aspects of it, and then there are voluntary sort of conscious voluntary pieces of it as well. So certainly a mixture.
There have been times in your life, you write, when you tried to approach the question of racism as something that was, you know, someone else's problem. Like, this is no concern to me. This is your thing. But you mentioned how that didn't really work out so well. Explain that.
Right. Yeah. So I can list numbers of instances where I just wanted to be Ted. And I didn't want to be Black Ted or the smart Black Ted or the Cosby Show middle class Black Ted.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be Ted. And unfortunately, you don't get to determine who other people think you are. And you don't get to determine the experiences that other people bring to those interactions. Right. So I can't remember a time when I wasn't conscious of the fact that I was a little bit different from a lot of the black kids who were my friends because I grew up in white suburbia. I was very aware of the fact that when I walked into some of my classes, I was the only black kid there. So I didn't just get to be Ted, because as soon as I walked in the room, there was immediately something very different about me when compared to my classmates. Because I lived in white suburbia for much of my elementary and middle school years, most of my friends were white. So I didn't get to be just Ted. I was always sort of like my black friend, Ted. When I went to their house, I was fortunate enough to have, you know, friends who were not so obsessed with race that it prevented our friendship. But again, when you're introduced as, hey, this is my black friend, Ted, it sort of reminds you that you're not the same. And it's not just white on black kind of thing. You know, even amongst my black friends, I remember a specific instance when I was in eighth grade and started to hang out with more of the black kids in the cafeteria, and one of them asked me, hey, when did you start acting black? I was like, wow, you know, wow. Mm. Even amongst people who are the same color as me noticed that I was a little bit different. But that's not unique to race or class, for that matter. I mean, all of us are unique in our own little way. And especially in the uncomfortable years of adolescence, the differences between you and those you hang around and other people are extremely noticeable. The other part of that, though, is that those are formative years for your identity. And
yeah.
So because of that, I was aware at a very early age that I was a little bit different from almost everyone I interacted with.
You've called it code switching. And there are a few times in your writing when you mention something W.E.B. Du Bois wrote about, what he called this two-ness in American black people. There's the American part and then there's the black part.
Right.
As he said, which this is terrific, the way he puts it, the warring ideals, two warring ideals in one dark body. And you refer to it also as this kind of double consciousness. And I wanted you to just say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So there's the race and the class piece of this again. So being black and middle class in suburbia, there was sort of that piece of it. But I tell you, I wear the uniform. And so I've made the oath that I would protect the country, or at least to the best of my abilities, and even give my life in doing so. So because I wear the cloth of the nation, it's very difficult for me to hear other people trash the nation or say that America is just this racist country that has only given incrementally given rights to black people because of for other reasons other than, you know, a true compassion for what blacks have been through or even an adherence to the founding principles. But I take that personally because, again, I wear the uniform. So I am this staunch, proactive, patriotic American, but I'm still black, and I still experience the very racism that makes a lot of people have a different view of what the country is, and I carry a lot of the faith and hope that black people have carried for centuries. Ever since we showed up in this country, we've had a faith or hope that one day freedom would kind of be ours and equal to opportunity would be realized. And I don't think, even though those ideas may be at odds with one another, I don't think they're incompatible. I don't think that they cannot coexist. And so the issue is, or the challenge is to live in both of those worlds without betraying either one, and being a good representative of each, and trying to sort of be the uniter, the unifier, and not key so much on the divisiveness there. So the W.E. Du Bois and his double consciousness. I mean, he's talking about that very problem about being Negro, as he calls it, and American. And for a country that was founded, you know, on the premise that all men are created equal, and then the subjugation that ensued, before, during, and after that proclamation was sort of scripted onto our souls, the American soul, that black folks didn't get to realize it. And I tell you, it is not an easy thing to put aside your blackness and defend America, or put aside your Americanness and defend black people, or at least advocate for them. And there's a line there that I think we all can walk, and that's sort of the warring is the tug of trying to be more race conscious or more patriotic, and sort of trying to walk that line and not betray either the race or the country, both of which I would love and give my life for either, and still coexist in a way that makes the idea I'm trying to represent more appealing and not more divisive.
It seems like one of the starting points for you in terms of having this conversation, a real conversation about race, is this, as I mentioned in the introduction, this admission that blackness is uncomfortable to some people. That's a starting point, you think? I mean, what does that mean, that whites need to be just a little bit more honest about their feelings or their real reactions and express it? Just, you know, talk about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, that idea is not something we sort of conjure up and then take to the – I mean, that's what the country tells us, that you are uncomfortable to me. All you have to do is look at the nightly news and see black faces left and right in committing various crimes as if those were the only crimes in the world that were committed last night were those by thuggish-looking black people.
Yeah.
When you put these sort of images out, then the world that views them comes across you and immediately associates you with those negative depictions, whether it's in media, music, the news, newspapers, whatever. And not to say these things don't exist and they shouldn't impact how people approach the country, but to apply that to every single person you meet is where it becomes problematic. And so the idea that blackness is a problem, that's not some ingenious observation that I came up with. That's what the country told me.
Right.
You know, that's when people grasp their purses or lock their car doors or switch the side of the street as I'm walking by, that's not my exerting my tough blackness on them. That's them telling me you're uncomfortable to me. And so once you realize that, then you begin to behave in a way, one, especially when you lived in suburbia like I did, you behave in a way that says, wait a minute, I know what you've seen and I'm not like that. And again, the burden is now on me to sort of disillusion people that all black people behave in a certain way. So I don't have much of a choice. Now that's a little bit of a false statement because, we do have choices. I could just be who I am and let people interact with me however they so choose. And, Trayvon Martin probably felt that way, and we see how that turned out. Jordan Davis probably felt that way. We see how they turned out. You know, these young black men, confident in just being able to, hey, I'm an American, and this isn't the 1960s. This isn't slavery. I should be able to walk through my neighborhood and being confronted with the fact that people don't feel safe around you, and either you make them feel safe or you can pay the ultimate price. You know, so there is a choice. I can choose to behave however I feel I am allowed to behave and, in fact, have earned the right to behave, if by no other reason in the fact that I wear the uniform. But I'm quickly disavowed of any of that because one misstep and the onus is on me to prove that I wasn't out to harm someone. And sometimes you don't even get the chance to explain.
Those reactions... Where do you figure they come from? I mean, you mentioned the images that we see in the media, for example. So that's a kind of conditioning, clearly, that happens that a lot of people probably aren't even that conscious about. But I also wondered if you have a sense that is there anything like biological about that reaction, not just to black people from white people, but the other way around, or different cultures reacting to others, if there's something kind of intuitive in us that makes us suspicious of other people, and that it's something you have to overcome, obviously. But if we sort of start from there in some ways, that there's something natural is not the right word, but there's something kind of in our genes that we have to combat.
Well, I don't know, and I know that there are tons of theories out there from. In biology and some of the other physical sciences about how human societies formed and how they usually formed, and they were sort of the same ethnicity and the same tribe, and anyone foreign to them immediately presented a threat. Therefore, there was no common human brotherhood. You know, that was something that we've sort of evolved to. So maybe there's and I don't think any of us can sort of discount the fact that we feel comfortable around people that are like us,
yeah.
Just sort of inherent. If for no other reason that the families we grow up in, for the most part, are people who look like us, and so we feel comfortable around other people like that. But that's such an immature approach to society that if you carry this prehistoric notion of tribal security into your fifth grade classroom or your boardroom. The implication is you haven't really evolved at all. I mean, it seems like we're past that a bit, but I do think there is some merit in the idea that when you encounter someone you've never seen before, or had close interactions with someone you've never been exposed to before, that there is some uncertainty there, and you're more likely to rely on the things you've heard from trusted sources, to precede your interaction with that person. I do think there's some value in that. But the whole point of it is being able to recognize it and then grow beyond it. If you've been alive for 30 years and you're still scared when you see a black person, that's no longer your biology talking.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of a societal conditioning that you're allowing to take hold. And so then it's beyond just the fight or flight security sort of notion that biology intimates. You know, this is a little bit more complicated than that. So I don't think we can fall back on the idea that we're all innately a little bit scared of something that doesn't look like us or someone that doesn't look like us. Maybe as a newborn, not as an adolescent or adult.
Yeah. Theodore Johnson is with us. He's a U.S. Navy commander and commentator on race and politics. He's joining us from Washington. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about race or racism in America. Over the last few months, there have been stories of people making some fairly clueless comments about race. Cliven Bundy was one. Donald Sterling was another. There have been others. But are those stories the exceptions or the rule? That is, are these just outliers, men from a different generation, or do they express a larger symptom of a bigger problem that is persisting? 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Theodore Johnson III, U.S. Navy commander, a White House fellow, and a commentator on race and politics is with us. We're joined now also by Debbie Irving, who is a racial justice educator and a writer who teaches at Wheelock College. Her new book is called Waking Up White, and she's joining us from a studio in Boston. And Debbie Irving, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I wanted to ask you a couple of questions to sort of lay some groundwork before we sort of move on in the conversation, because I want to get the sense of your book. And I wanted to ask you about something you write about in your book, where you say that for years you had kind of struggled to understand race and racism, but you had no way to make sense of the debates that you were seeing in the media or, you know, reading about. And then you began to take note of these certain things, that you wanted to have friends who were people of color, but you kept ending up with white people as friends. You talked about this kind of inexplicable tension and fear that you felt from time to time when you were around people of color. What was going on there? Was this the kind of sense of awareness? Because the book is in some ways kind of confessional about some of those feelings, and I wanted to talk about what you were thinking about.
Well, I was thinking about it in the context I was working as a nonprofit manager and one of my for an organization in Boston called First Night. And my charge was to bring together the many diverse neighborhoods of Boston. And I had, like Ted, I had grown up in a white suburb. But there were no people of color in my existence until age 22 when I moved to Boston and I got this job. And I couldn't make sense of the neighborhoods that I saw, how segregated it was. And I couldn't understand why when I went into one of these neighborhoods, I would be so full of fear. There was nobody overtly doing anything threatening. And, you know, you asked right before the break, is fear biological? And the way I understand it now, I think fear is biological, but what we are taught to fear is socialized. Mm. And a huge part of being socialized in America includes being racialized, and that means taught to have beliefs and a value system ordered around racial identity. And all of that was completely foreign to me. And part of the fear was a shame for having that fear. And so you might ask, well, why didn't you go talk to someone and say, gee, I have this fear I can't figure out? Well, I was ashamed of being afraid. So that was a big part of what kept me silent. And kept me not looking for answers.
Yeah, and you talk about this kind of silence as a kind of an epidemic going on. You say that One of the – because you write about some of the obstacles to actually talking about this stuff, and one of them is, you know, admitting certain things to ourselves about the way we feel. You say because we don't want to feel like we're racist or somehow – we somehow feel think about ourselves as – I'm not sure how you quite put it, but sort of racially neutral because we're white. And that was a stumbling block, you mentioned, for you, this idea that because you're white, you didn't think you had a race. And I wanted you to talk about that.
Oh, yeah. I thought white was just normal and that all the other races – by the way, race is a social construction, so to even use the word race now feels sort of fraudulent to me. But all the other people who had been given racial labels other than white, to me, my idea was their value was measured from a starting point of white. That white was normal, and these were all sort of deviations from this white as normal. Again, I couldn't have given language to any of that, and that's part of the problem is that when a problem is invisible, as it can be to white people, that whiteness is actually a big part of the problem, there's no language for it. So a big part of my journey has been to do a lot of reading and be a part of conversations where I learn the language so that I can explore inside myself and the structures throughout history that have created this these divisions so that it's no longer invisible and that I can describe what I'm seeing and what I'm feeling.
You write about listening to this intuitive voice that is telling you something's not right. But it seems like there's two ways of thinking about this sense of intuition. The intuitive part of us that seems to be racist. I mean, you say learning to listen to that voice is about rewiring your intuition. And we were talking a little bit with Theodore Johnson, who I want to get back into the conversation here in a moment. But the idea, as you mentioned, about the biology of it or whether or not there's something inherent in it. So there's an intuition that's telling us it's not right, but there's also an intuition that that may be racist? Explain that, if you would.
Well, here, I actually have a great little story that just happened within the last hour. Hmm. I'm in Boston. I come into the studio. We're setting me up, got the headphones on, and I'm waiting for you guys to call in. And I'm listening to the Diane Rehm show. It's about the Declaration of Independence in this book that was just written. And I apologize for I don't know the author's name. But I was listening to that and hearing clips of it and thinking, oh, I love America. I mean, like Theodore or Ted, I'm not sure how he likes to be called. But what was that?
Ted is good.
Ted's cool. Okay.
Ted. Okay. Hi, Ted. Thanks. Like Ted, I'm a staunch patriotic pro-American. You know, I so have bought in to the idea that America is a land of the free and that equality is something that can be achieved and should be achieved. And, you know, and America is the place to do it. And so here I am in one part of my mind. I'm hearing that and I'm getting all pumped up. It's the 4th of July, Declaration of Independence. Yay. Meanwhile, I'm scrolling through Ted's website, just to get, you know, a better sense of who's Ted. And I see that an article he's written is in there is called Upper Class Black Men. And in this instant, I get this idea, black men can't be upper class. So in that moment, I get this little stab in my gut. If I hadn't developed the level of racial consciousness that I'm constantly working to develop, I would have gone right over that. I wouldn't have noticed that I felt that, even though I would have felt it. So there's this dissonance that lives in me and will live in me my whole life. I feel the best I can do is become conscious of it and stop and say, oh, my God, did you actually just have that thought? Yes, you did have that thought. Wow. And then investigate, where did that come from? I've been doing some deep investigation for a few years, so I know exactly where that came from. But I encourage, you know, white Americans to really pay attention to those little moments where you get that stab in your gut that's like, ugh. And you've had a thought that you wish you didn't have, but it's in there, and it's really worth exploring.
Well, it's the interesting part of one of the interesting parts of your book is there's almost this kind of process that you go through. You suggest that people, you know, write a journal, or you even offer these exercises to work through these feelings and realizations, and you have these questions at the ends of these chapters. And I guess the point of that is to come to that sense of consciousness, to say, all right, where did that come from? What was the influence of that? How did I come up with this idea that somehow black people could not be upper class or whatever that might be, right? It's about awareness. It's about consciousness.
Yes, very much so. And I, you know, I'm a racial justice educator. I do teach at Wheelock College. I also go all over the country and do workshops. And what I find, for instance, the same story, the story that Ted told about going to the track early in the morning.
Yeah.
I've heard that story in so many iterations all over the country. And no matter where we are, we find that many white people have internalized very similar messages. And Ted could probably say that black people all over the country have internalized very similar messages. The reason this is happening is all over the country is because we have national, federal structures that have created a history that has divided us. And there have been some myths, many myths in the ideology that have been embedded in structures that that have led us to this point. And I don't want to hog all the airtime, but I could tell you, I think hearing about systems and structures can be very confusing for people who aren't, you know, have been spending a lot of time in this conversation. I can offer up one if there's time.
Sure.
Okay. So, like I said, grew up in a white suburb, Winchester, Massachusetts. I just thought that my parents picked that town because it was a nice little town and a good commute from Boston, and that some of that is true. But what's also true is that my dad was in World War II. He was in the Navy, like Ted. After World War II, all these veterans came home to the GI Bill. There were 1 million black GIs who also came home, and yet only 2% of the black GIs were able to access the GI Bill, which provided free education and very low-interest housing loans. And on the housing front, a black person, it didn't say anywhere in the GI Bill that blacks need not apply. And yet, if the GI Bill was going to offer lending through the Federal Housing Authority, which is how it worked, the Federal Housing Authority would not lend in a neighborhood where a black person lived. Because at that time, property values were evaluated on two things. One, the condition of the building, and two, the skin color of the residents. So it was impossible for black GIs to access the housing piece of that bill. So there's an example of how I ended up. I didn't just kind of randomly end up in a white neighborhood. That was a socially engineered white town.
Yeah.
And the fact that I was in an all-white town meant that black and brown people had been barred from being in that town and left in inferior housing. When you think about housing and what that gets you, that gives you proximity to superior education, medical care, transportation systems, food supplies. And so the impact of housing is huge. And the fact that our housing system has been racialized is something most people can't see. I didn't see it until I talk in the book about what woke me up was taking this course.
Yeah.
So there's missing history. And if we are missing history, there's no way on earth we can live up to our own ideals of freedom and equality for all.
Theodore Johnson, I want to get you back involved in this conversation. And there's sort of a lot to go through there. Give me your sense of reaction, first of all, about what Debbie Irving was talking about in terms of just this idea of being conscious of these feelings, you know, stopping and saying, okay, where did this come from, this feeling? What do you make of that?
I absolutely agree. Because overcoming it isn't something that you pick up in a classroom and then walk out at the end of the lesson feeling better about yourself. It's a true self-examination. And if you don't do the work to sort of recognize where you're falling short and then make some measure or some effort to improve yourself, then you're totally missing just how difficult a problem it is and what you contribute to the problem. And again, I don't think that when I passed those white women on the track and sort of shrinked off to the side so as not to be threatening, I wasn't furthering the race conversation. I wasn't contributing to a better America. I was avoiding the conversation. The first thing to counter that avoidance is to recognize the action you're taking or the action the involuntary action that's been taken and realize that this isn't how it should be and what can I do to make it better. I once asked a professor sort of the same question, and I told her that I felt like I was walking around in a bubble of preemptive apologies. everywhere I went, I was sort of apologizing. Hey, I'm not a threat. Hey, I don't mean to scare you or anything. I'm one of the safe ones. And I asked her, when does that bubble go away? And her answer was with age. And I'll tell you, just in the last 3 years alone, I've become much more confident in those instances where there's sort of a subtle hint that maybe I could be taken the wrong way. I just don't care anymore. You know, I don't shrink in that instant anymore, because if there's no confrontation of how that person, how I feel that person may view me, then there's no healing in it. There's no getting better. And so just recently have I started to, instead of avoiding the uncomfortable moment, sort of standing tall in it. Recognizing that there are some moments where that's not possible. I think in one of my articles, I talked about being pulled over by the police for a busted headlight, and I ended up cuffed on the back of my car. That's not the moment to make a stand, say, look, I'm an officer in the military. You can't treat me like this, because it was late at night. It was in the middle of no one else was around. It could have gone badly for me. So there are times where you sort of have to suck up the fact that you get treated a little bit different, and then handle that injustice in another venue at another time. But then there are those everyday social interactions where you can stand tall and refuse to play into the system that racism is sort of built around us.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take some calls. Linda is with us, calling from Bountiful, Utah. Linda, welcome.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to share the University of Texas college students. I had a black roommate, a wonderful experience. We had a great time, but occasionally when she was in all-white groups, she would get extremely nervous. And then one weekend I went to stay with her family in another town, and I was the only white person, and I was graciously treated, and it was a wonderful experience. But I was anxious the whole time. My heart was racing. I sweated. And I finally told her, I get it. I mean, there's no reason for this, but I am frightened, and I didn't have any reason to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, look, Debbie Irvin, does it make sense to you? I want to hear you on this, and Theodore Johnson, too.
Oh, I just think that's such a great story. I think this is why segregated housing is so terrible and segregated everything. Schooling, Ted talked about the tribal security. The more we continue to segregate ourselves, either by housing or by grouping, we're missing out on these opportunities to heal from this deep, deep fear that has been passed down to us. You know, nobody alive today invented this, and I think most people don't want it. I know there are some people who you mentioned earlier who seem to be the standouts in the sensationalized news reports. But what we don't hear enough about are all the deeply compassionate people who want racial healing but are not quite sure how to achieve it. It's getting over this fear, and that does mean getting ourselves in each other's shoes to the extent we can and actually spending time together and having open conversations just like we're having now.
Mm. Theodore Johnson.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think that story is amazing. One of the questions I posed to some military leadership years ago was, how do you take the black kid from inner city, you name it, goes to Harriet Tubman Elementary School, Martin Luther King Middle School, Booker T. Washington High School, then off to a historically black university, then you put them in the boardroom where they're the only black person, and then they're sort of given low marks because they're seen as not a team player, doesn't want to hang out with the guys, always is off to himself. It's like that black person doesn't know how to behave in those instances. It's not that they're sort of wanting to disassociate themselves. It's that it's unfamiliar, right? And so our charge is to sort of recognize that and to make them feel included. And I think your example is one of the best ways to do that, is to go to a place where you're the only person of your color in the room and note just how awkward it feels, even though no one has threatened you, no one said, and in fact, the fact that no one's talked to you is probably, you know, just as uncomfortable as if someone were to talk to you. That feeling is what a lot of minorities carry around with them in tons of social interactions. And then when they seem a little awkward or seem like, well, you know, he's not like the rest of the guys, then it's, you know, it's that whole race thing is in the way. There's a barrier there when it's really just the normalization hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. Conversely, when that minority feels very comfortable in that environment, like drop me in a room full of white people and I feel pretty good because that's how I grew up. Sometimes people of your race will look at you and say, who does he think he is, yeah. you know, to move in those spaces and not pay us attention or whatever the perception is. So there's an awakening that needs to happen on both sides. But I think your experience is a great way to start the conversation.
Linda, thanks. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take more of your calls when we get back from a break. Theodore Johnson is with us. He is a U.S. Navy commander and a writer and commentator on race and politics in America. And Debbie Irving is with us, a racial justice educator and writer who teaches at Wheelock College. Her new book is called Waking Up White. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about race in America, racism in America. We have with us Theodore Johnson III and Debbie Irving. And you can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. John is with us in Salt Lake City. John, welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about sort of a confusion that we're having here between color and culture. You know, we use color, we call it race, we use it as a cultural marker psychologically. And, you know, this is, it's not a natural thing what we're trying to do in this country. We're trying to mix cultures together, and that's sort of a grand experiment. But we get sidetracked into the color question, and so we don't understand, you know, why it seems so odd when somebody is sort of visually of a different culture. Normally, that's just a situation cultures don't live in the same areas.
Theodore Johnson, what do you think about that?
I understand the question. And so all I would point out is that the African-American culture doesn't have a color associated with it. In my family alone, I have a niece who is just as black as I am, but has strawberry blonde hair and hazel eyes because our great grandfather was an Irish Scots-Irish immigrant. So the color question, that implies that when you look at someone, you can assume based on their color, you know, their culture. Take color out of it. The African American culture is sort of the is where the racism is sort of comes in. Certainly, the darker the person gets, the more black they appear. And so the stereotypes that attend the African-American culture seem to be extremely pronounced the darker the skin color is. But I think it's much deeper than color. I think the caller does have a point is whenever you mix cultures, whether it's, you know, England and France 500 years ago or the experiment that we call America, there is this tension that's inherent there because the person across from me is not like me and I don't know what to expect. And so either we make them behave like us or there's a problem that we got to figure out probably the hard way. So I do think we are still struggling with how to pull these cultures together. But a lot of the folks that bring up that opinion also would say, why do we have to separate each other? You know, why do you call yourselves African hyphen Americans? Why can't we just be all Americans? It's because there's not really such a thing as the American culture yet. Until there's a homogenous American culture, the culture question is one we're not going to escape from. And arguably, having to confront it is what makes the country great instead of avoiding it like a lot of the other homogenous countries, you know, have the luxury of doing.
Hmm. Debbie Irving, what do you think?
Well, I would just build on what Ted said, and that the process of building an American culture that's inclusive of many other cultures I think, would make every human being a better human being, because we'd all have to stretch ourselves a little bit, both to understand our own culture and to consider other cultures not as deficient or a step down from, you know, I could look at any other culture as a step down from mine because mine feels the most familiar to me. But when I start to see my culture in a more objective way, and then start to look at other people's cultures, I learn a lot about myself and about other people and what makes – there are a lot of choices in terms of the way we relate to time, in terms of the way we choose to communicate, in terms of the way we choose to live together as families. And those show up a little differently in every culture. There's so much to be learned by studying that.
Thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join us. Patricia with us in Salt Lake City. Patricia, hi.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my call. This is a perfectly fascinating show. I've spent many years in Utah and spent the last 4 years living in Annapolis, Maryland, and it's a completely different kind of place in all kinds of ways. One of the nicest things is that I've become good friends with at least three or four people that we call African Americans. The second thing I wanted to say is that there is a new book called The New Jim Crow, written by a young black American woman who's a lawyer with two small children, that talks about stuff that is so horrifying, it's unbelievable. I think anyone who's interested in finding out about the problems of racism and what happens in this country if you're not white should be reading that book. It's very difficult, it's very long, but it's very, very important. The third thing I wanted to say is that I'm a Unitarian Universalist. And in the Unitarian Church in Annapolis, they have a year-and-a-half-long course called, I think it's called How to Build the World That You Want or That You Hope For. And one of the important things about it is teaching all of us who take the class how very racist we are for all kinds of reasons that we have no idea of how it happened. One of the things that I found really fascinating was realizing how often women who are black and not white go to stores and are accused of shoplifting or followed around the store, which to make sure they don't shoplift. And I was just appalled by that because I would never suspect that anyone would ever think that of me. So it must be very uncomfortable to be a black grandmother in some stores. Thanks for a wonderful show, and thank you, Commander, for your service. You're a great spokesman for the service and the racial problem. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Theodore John, anything to follow up there? I mean, said a couple of things there.
Yeah. I'm familiar with the book she mentioned, which talks about the shuffling of basically the black men in prison problem. I think there was a recent study that mentioned something like of the entire imprisoned population in the world, 8% are black men, and never mind that, black American men, and not even just black Americans. And so even though we make up a minuscule portion of the world population, I mean, we're only 13 or 14% of the country, divide that by half, and that's the number of black men, and we make 8% of the prison population in the world. It's incredible. So that has ramifications. But the other thing I want to say very quickly is that all racism isn't malicious. You know, every time someone acts in a way that you would deem racist doesn't mean they're out to get you. All racism doesn't wear white hoods and ride around lynching black people or follow you around the store. A lot of times this stuff, as Debbie mentioned, it's so systematic that it becomes just the way of life. And you have to stop and pause and consider those sort of daily interactions that have ramifications for the people that are involved that may not come from a place of malice, but absolutely have long-term impacts. That's where I think we can make the most progress in race relations.
I want to make time for one more phone call before we're finished here. Let me get to Corey, who's with us in Salt Lake City. Corey, welcome.
Yes, hi. I am the mother of three African-American boys. I adopted them all when they were babies. I have embraced not just them, but their birth families, their ethnicity. I cannot imagine my life without that experience. And as scary as it is for us to step across those race lines and get to know somebody who's different from us, it's just that important as well. Because my life is so enriched because of this experience. I cannot imagine it without that now. Take a deep breath, get past that fear, and get to know someone different from me.
You know, that's interesting. I wondered, and Theodore Johnson and Debbie Irving, if you'd say something about that, finally, this sort of exponential effect that you have. I mean, once you cross over that boundary, it's a pretty expansive place. Would you say something about that, finally? We have about a minute or so left.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I had heard someone say when you step across that line, it would be expansive, I think I would think, oh, the world will be my oyster in terms of friends. I can have my pick of all these different people. But in fact, that expansiveness feels much more spiritual to me. Hmm. It's an unburdening and an unleashing of constrictions that were put on me as I was socialized in terms of what was right and wrong. And that means in terms of feelings that were right and wrong to have. People who were right and wrong to have in my life, places that were right and wrong to go. And so I can't think of a better way to say it than to feel like I really feel rewired. I feel that my natural circuitry that I was born with, which includes intuition and, you know, deep empathy and compassion and intellectual capacity, that all those things have been wired together because of raising my racial consciousness.
Theodore Johnson, about 30 seconds or so. Sorry for the – but final word to you.
So I would just say to the caller, your boys are lucky, lucky, lucky to have you. And that moment, and it will come, when the world, when America, when the nation throws their color in their face – the best thing you can do for them is continue to be the loving mother, and then everything else sort of works itself out. So I do think there is value in the races sort of living together, and as the caller mentioned, and the impacts will be for her and her boys, but the broader question is one that is going to take a lot more interaction.
Yeah. Theodore Johnson, U.S. Navy commander, writer, and commentator on race and politics in America. He joined us from Washington, D.C. Theodore Johnson, thanks to you very much.
Thank you.
And Debbie Irving, she's a racial justice educator and writer. Her book is Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. Thanks very much to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Michael Shea is our intern. He produced the show today. The program produced also by, of course, Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.